You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We'd like to thank our friends at ZipRecruiter for their continued support of Spycast. I'll tell you more about this great company later, but first, let's meet our guests. So we're joined today by Jason Fagoni, who's a journalist who covers science, technology, and culture. He was named one of the 10 young writers on the rise by the Columbia Journalism Review. And he's a contributor to the Huffington Post Highline and has written for GQ, Esquire, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Mother Jones, Philadelphia Magazine, and others. He's also the author of Ingenious, A True Story of Invention, The X Prize in the Race to Revive America, and what has to be in my top five list of greatest titles of all time, Horsemen of the Esophagus, Competitive Eating and the Big Fat American Dream. His newest book is The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. Welcome, Jason. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
I'm glad. Thank you for having me, Vince.
Yeah, that book, author's dream is to come up with the kind of pun that is. So
I've gotten a couple of questions lately about, like, how did I make the leap from Horsemen of the Esophagus writing about competitive eating to writing about code breaking, and there is no link. There's no link. It's just me.
It just happened. I mean, I often ask authors about the inspiration for the book, partly because it makes for a good icebreaker to start a conversation,
yeah.
Partly because we have listeners who are either budding authors or established authors, and it's in the processes of successful authors is always good to hear. But I also rarely read the promotional material sent by publishing companies that get, you know, sent with the books when they send them to us.
Yeah, yeah.
In this case, I'm actually glad I did, because the story of your early inspiration for this book is really great. You know, you being on an airplane. And talk a little bit about that? Because that to me really sets the story in a context that I want to go after.
Sure. So about 3 years ago, I was on a Delta flight with my wife and daughter. She was six, just a normal Delta flight. I am pretty tall, and so I'm usually uncomfortable on planes, so I was not having a good time. The flight was dragging on, and the stewardess came by and offered my daughter a special drink. She asked her if she would like a Sky Princess, which I had never heard of before, but it was it's a mixture of cranberry juice and ginger ale. So she pours this for my daughter, and my daughter starts to drink it. She's enjoying it. It looks really good to me. I'm tired. I'm, you know, uncomfortable. I want one of these drinks. I want a Sky Princess. And so I say to the stewardess, can I have a Sky Princess too? And she looks at me and she says, oh, no. For boys, it's called a Sky Pilot. And my wife next to me, like, sort of jabbed me in the side with her elbow, like, really hard. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, number one, it's the same drink, right, for a boy or a girl. Number two, I think as a father, you start to think about maybe with a heightened sensitivity, the kinds of small messages that girls get sent as they move through the world. And, you know, Stuart is not meaning to do anything bad, but it's one of hundreds of little messages that get sent like that. And I just started to think that I should try to write a book that my daughter would be able to read someday and be inspired by. So that kind of pushed me toward a direction of looking for a cool story of a woman pioneer. My wife is in tech, and she goes to the Grace Hopper conference every year. She told me a little bit about who Grace Hopper was, so I started looking into women technologists, women technology pioneers. And around that same time was when the Edward Snowden story broke. And so I started reading about the history of NSA. I think, like a lot of Americans, I really didn't know much about NSA. Mm-hmm. So I was reading about NSA, where this agency came from. When you read about NSA, all roads lead to William Friedman.
Right.
You know, godfather of the NSA. I don't have to tell anybody who listens to this podcast who William Friedman is or what he means. But, you know, I happen to read in reading about William Friedman that he had a wife, and she was also a codebreaker. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Husband and wife, codebreaker. And I started looking for more information. I assumed there had to be a book, but there was no book about Elizabeth. And so all of these things kind of came together to motivate me to find out more about Elizabeth Friedman. And that's when the story started to unfold.
Yeah. There are times as a historian where we get really lucky and stumble onto something that no one else has seen or cared to see, or they did see it but didn't know what it meant. And I imagine things might be similar for journalists in this case, where you know, the case for Elizabeth Friedman, you set out to find information, and then you stumble onto just heaps of this stuff that no one had paid any attention to before.
Right. Well, Vince, have you had a moment in an archive where you came across a document and you just wanted to, like, cry out in excitement? Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of moments for me like that during the reporting of this. I mean, usually you can't make any kind of loud noise in an archive because there are other people right next to you who are doing their own research. They would be upset. But yeah, the first day that I started reading Elizabeth's papers was like that. So Elizabeth left 22 boxes of her personal letters, diaries, original code worksheets to the George Marshall Foundation in Lexington, Virginia. The Marshall also has William Friedman's collection, which is larger. But I think a lot of historians who have gone to the Marshall over the years have gone there to look at William's stuff. It's a rare thing for somebody to go there and ask to see Elizabeth's collection. And that's what they told me when I went there. They said that sometimes they suggest to people, you should really look at William's Elizabeth's stuff, and they don't have as much luck. Part of the problem is that Elizabeth's collection is not indexed. It's not annotated because she really she only annotated William's stuff.
Right, she took the time to annotate William's stuff.
Yeah,
on her own. Yeah,
partly probably out of modesty, partly out of a sense of duty to him. But there's no really guide to what's in those 22 boxes. If you want to know what's in there, you have to go through every box from start to finish. But yeah, it was that experience of going there for the first time, being led back into the vault where the 22 boxes are, requesting box one, looking at box one, file one, and then, you know, very quickly realizing that here was an untold story that really deserved to be told. And, you know, Elizabeth was, like William, a pack rat. You know, she kept every piece of paper that passed through her hands that was not classified. And so anything that you could want as a journalist, a historian, a biographer is in those files, or most anything. You know, going back to the earliest love letters that she wrote to William before they were even married. I mean, it was just wonderful stuff. And I was completely captivated.
Well, I mean, as we know now, I mean, thankfully, a lot of reason because of your book, but also because there's been some changes of late about bringing her back, you know, out of the shadows. She, of course, is one of the greatest codebreakers of all time. She almost wasn't one to begin with. I mean, she was kind of an accidental codebreaker in many respects. She almost went back home after being unable to find a job in Chicago, but just so happened. It's one of these moments, right, where what if she hadn't gone into the Newberry Library in Chicago and just said, nah, I'm just going to go home? I mean, one of these twists of fate that just defined history for all of us moving forward for the next, you know, almost next 100 years.
she always called her career an accident. First person article that she wrote about her life as a codebreaker was titled "Pure Accident," and it's really true. That's how it began. So, one of these classic American tales: a young girl from a small town is bored with her life. She wants something more. It was 1916. Elizabeth was 23 years old. She was working as a school teacher, which is essentially what a bright young woman did.
Basically all they could do.
It was the end of the line. Right. You know, if you had an education at a liberal arts university in 1916, you became a school teacher. Not a college teacher. You taught, grade school. And that's what Elizabeth was doing in a tiny town in Indiana that was very much like the tiny town where she grew up, and she just got sick of it and quit her job. She decided that she wanted something more unusual. So she lit out for the big city. She took a train to Chicago, and she looked for a job for about a week and a half, had zero luck. Finally, she was about to give up and go back home, live with her parents, and she decided before she was going home, she wanted to see a rare book of Shakespeare that was held at the Newberry Library. It was a private library for rich people, essentially. Elizabeth wasn't rich. She went to the library anyway. And she started to examine this 1623 edition of Shakespeare's plays, the first folio. As she was looking at this book, the librarian noticed that she was interested in Shakespeare. Elizabeth had studied Shakespeare in college. And the librarian struck up a conversation and said, there's this crazy rich guy who keeps coming to the library looking at that Shakespeare book. And he's convinced that there are secret messages inside it. And he said that he was looking to hire a research assistant. Would you be interested in that sort of job? And Elizabeth said, well, yeah, maybe. Librarian said, should I call him up? Elizabeth said, okay. Thinking that it would take weeks. Within an hour, this crazy rich guy comes to the Newberry Library to pick Elizabeth up in his chauffeured limousine. And essentially it takes her by the elbow, walks her out to the limo, and whisks her away to his private estate on the Illinois prairie that is like half a rich man's paradise and half a bizarre scientific laboratory. It was called Riverbank, and that's kind of how her career in code breaking began.
And for those out there, the Riverbank, some of you may ring a bell. I mean, it's kind of the mecca, the founding organization of American code breaking. But for others, you do describe it pretty well, right? It's bringing together not just code people, it's all sorts of different scientists who were being funded by this wacky rich dude.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, George Fabian was very much like the wealthy men of the Gilded Age, people like Andrew Carnegie or William Randolph Hearst. The difference is that Fabian didn't spend his money on building a huge castle like Hearst did, or he didn't spend his money on collecting French Impressionist paintings like Carnegie did. Instead, he spent his money on science and scientific laboratories and scientific experiments. He wanted to discover the secrets of nature. And over a period of about a decade, he transformed his estate, this Riverbank estate, into an impressive private scientific laboratory like some of the private labs of his day, Thomas Edison's Menlo Park or Nikola Tesla's lab on Long Island. And so Riverbank really was like Thomas Edison's Menlo Park laboratory or Nikola Tesla's laboratory in New York, or at least part of it was. It was really kind of like a fusion of rich man's playground and scientific ambition. So you would have all of the classic rich guy stuff. You would have, famous people coming to have huge, lavish dinners with George Fabian. Teddy Roosevelt sat at his table. Lily Langtry and Billy Burke, Flo Ziegfeld, some of the famous sort of actors and actresses and producers of the day would just go there to hang out because they were all part of the same sort of wealthy class. But then you would also have, the leading acoustical investigator in the United States had a lab there. You would also have somebody like William Friedman, young and talented geneticist who was there. And then you had this group of literature scholars that Elizabeth was a part of who were investigating these supposedly secret messages embedded in Shakespeare.
And you mentioned William Friedman was a geneticist, but eventually got a little bored with what he was doing and was recruited I don't know if you can say because he was interested in Elizabeth or because he was interested in the work. One way or another, he was recruited into looking at some of the codes in Shakespeare, and they found they worked exceptionally well together. Even before there was any kind of romantic involvement, there was just this kind of personal, professional coming together of like minds that just would work together great for decades following.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they started writing to each other before they were ever romantically involved. And those letters are in the Marshall Foundation. It is amazing to read, you know, these love letters 100 years later. Like, I would be in the Marshall, and, you know, at the end of the day, I would spend 8 hours there looking at the letters. At the end of the day, I would send my wife, you know, a text. It would be like, I love you, with, like, you know, a love emoji. It's just like, it's so lame. Right. It's so pathetic and lame. They just wrote better love letters 100 years ago. And they wrote to each other when they were just friends, but even then they had this very obvious and beautiful bond on the page. And in real life, sitting across the table from each other, you know, in the pre-computer era, solving these puzzles together, they were two young people who were very ambitious, I think, and they wanted to accomplish great things, and I think they saw that ambition in each other. They wanted to leave a mark, and they talked about that. And as they fell in love, their letters grew more intimate, and within a year, they were married.
And you mentioned at the beginning the time period we're talking about here is when the rest of the world is fighting a war in World War One, and soon after, relatively soon after Elizabeth arrives at Riverbank, the United States is pulled into the war. And this is not a situation like it is today where there are tens of thousands of people working on signals intelligence and cryptology.
Right.
We're really talking about a handful, count on one hand,
yes,
kind of handful of people who understood codes and ciphers in the United States, and two of them were William and Elizabeth Friedman.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that I found really surprising. I mean, you and the people listening to this show already know this, but for me, it was a shock to see how tiny and kind of unprepared the intelligence community was at the dawn of World War One. I mean, you couldn't even really call it an intelligence community. Right. I mean, there was no NSA, obviously, no CIA. FBI was about 8 years old, really just a shadow of its future self. And, you know, there was no trained corps of codebreakers. There was only these weirdos looking at Shakespeare texts out in the middle of the Illinois prairie.
Well, and for the first almost year of the war, really, William and Elizabeth and their team did all the code breaking for the entirety of the U.S. government. It wasn't like they were just doing bits and pieces of it. They were it.
It was every agency would send their stuff out to Riverbank. You know, Army, Department of Justice, all of the different arms of government that needed secret messages solved. They would funnel it out to the prairie, out to Riverbank, and the answers would come back.
And people may wonder why have Riverbank Labs be like kind of the central point of U.S. code breaking, but it's not that the government didn't try to bring at least William Friedman in and make him an official part of the establishment.
Right.
Fabian was blocking the correspondence and not allowing them to even leave.
Right. George Fabian was a lunatic. He was an insane person. You know, his insanity probably masked by his power and his wealth. You know, he was the kind of person who just had so much money that he could build a kind of kingdom around himself. And you know, he was also very large and forceful and scary guy. He was 240 pounds, you know, 6'4", big iron gray beard. People were afraid to say no to him, and he was also very charming and persuasive, and so he managed to build this little empire out on the prairie, build up this code-breaking team, and it was a combination, really, of American desperation, the fact that there wasn't already a core of trained code-breakers, and also sort of Fabian's just forcefulness and charm that allowed him to gain so much power and so much control over the American code-breaking world.
Well, and now the center point of American code-breaking is out in the middle of nowhere. The government's really forced to send not only codes to be broken there, but also anyone that needs to be trained. And so Riverbank Labs becomes now not only a center point of U.S. code breaking, but also a training school for the next generation of American code breakers.
That's right. And again, you know, the government didn't like doing this. They were very uneasy about George Fabian, you know, but they didn't really have a choice because it was war. And so you're right. They started sending bright, young Army officers out to Illinois to learn the basics of codes and ciphers from Elizabeth and William. I think the first four were sent out in November 1917. Mm-hmm. And then that was followed by an entire class of Army officers, as many as 80 officers, who were put up in a hotel in Aurora, Illinois. A lot of them brought their wives, and for these Army officers, it was like living in paradise before they were about to be deployed.
Right.
You know, it's like they're out in the farmland. Fabian, you know, would serve these lavish dinners with sort of freshly slaughtered hogs and chickens from the farm out there, and you know, it was a respite, and Elizabeth and William were teaching these classes, and it's incredible to think about because they were so young. You know, they're really just in their early to mid 20s, and had only learned about code breaking, you know, 1915, 1916. But all of a sudden, they were the experts. That Elizabeth always said that we had to become the students and the teachers at the same time because the timeline was just so compressed.
Well, William was eventually able to escape, for lack of a better word, and was deployed to France, actually, as part of the military. Is this where we kind of see the differences and the way people thought about them begin to diverge? Because his reputation skyrockets, and she's still back at Riverbank Labs, and you kind of see them going in different directions when it comes to who knows William versus who knows Elizabeth.
Right. So William had been wanting to serve, to go to France. He had been bugging George Fabian for permission to do so. Fabian had denied him at first, and ultimately William made such a stink about it that Fabian allowed him to go. He developed a bulletproof reputation serving with the AEF in their code section. Superior officers would come over to his table, and he would be introduced as the Wizard of Codes. And part of that was because some of his earliest publications were beginning to come out at that point, the Riverbank publications, mm-hmm. which I guess people listening to this will know.
Well, if they don't, when we open our new museum next year, we have William Friedman's personal copy of one of those Riverbank publications. So, I want to ask about the publications.
Yeah.
I mean, we also have their book plates, which are fantastic.
Oh, I love the book plate. I love the book plate.
The publications themselves, she was just as important for making those publications as he was, but he's given essentially the sole author credit, well, other than Fabian, who has to find his way on everything. But everyone up until very recently thought, well, yeah, William Friedman wrote all the Riverbank Labs pubs, but she was essentially a co-author on everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, he calls them our publications in letters that he writes to Elizabeth from France. He considers them to be their dual work. The case, I think, is proven by the records of the Riverbank Cipher Division that are now at the New York Public Library. So there's about 20 to 30 boxes of stuff from the earliest days of Riverbank at the New York Public Library. It's not really sorted, but I went and I dug through these boxes for a couple of days, and it turns out that the earliest drafts of the Riverbank publications are there, and guess what? Both of their handwriting is all over them. You know, so you have typescripts of these of what would become the Riverbank publications, and you know, Elizabeth's handwriting is making editing marks, and then William's handwriting is making editing marks. Sometimes you see in the typescripts that Elizabeth will write a section and she'll put her name, and then William will write a section and put his name. They're editing each other, but when these things get published by George Fabian's press, All of that information gets blotted out, and it just becomes William's work somehow. And so I think part of that is just the time. I think Elizabeth, as the wife, was expected to support the husband for the development of his reputation. And I think it's also her modesty. You know, she was modest to the point of self-abnegation. You know, but the famous early papers, the Running Key paper. You know, she said at the time, and he did too, that that was both of their work. But I think that of the eight papers, she was involved in the majority of them.
We'll have more with Jason in just 1 minute, but let me take a moment to tell you about ZipRecruiter. As I've told you before, ZipRecruiter is a company that was founded by a group of guys who worked in the tech industry and with startups and realized the absolute worst thing about running an organization was the process of hiring people. But what if hiring could be easier, more streamlined, and less time-consuming? So even when you're busy, you could still be smart about the way you hire. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying quality candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. And this is a really cool concept. You can even get a head start in the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates. So you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just 1 day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish all in one place. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/spycast. That's ZipRecruiter.com/spycast. One more time to try it free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/spycast. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The United States wasn't involved in World War I for all that long, you know, so there wasn't a chance to really get a huge thing going. And of course, during the interwar period, as many people know, both the United States military and our defense sector altogether essentially collapses. And although U.S. code breaking wasn't terrible during the war, it basically disappears in the interwar period. In the book, you chalk this up a lot to the rise of the machines, kind of you know, the end of pencil and paper code breaking. Is this based on what you researched and what you experienced? You really kind of put this as the primary reason that U.S. code breaking and people like these small labs like Elizabeth and William Friedman aren't able to continue the growth that they've established during the war.
What is the sort of consensus view of that? Because I'm not a historian. I know what sort of the conventional wisdom on that is.
I mean, you know, it's certainly there's economics involved in this as well. I mean, there's reasons not to keep the high levels of, money going to national security, particularly code breaking. You see it more as a bit of a balkanization of American national security, especially code breaking side, where things are broken down into small shops.
Right.
You know, Herbert Yardley in the State Department's a great example of this. You know, there's no NSA that brings together
right
all these different areas, and so everyone's kind of dealing with their own little fiefdom.
My sense of it was mainly that the urgency of war went away, and so people kind of scattered to the winds. I don't know if that's.
I think that
squares with.
It does, and I think that not only do you have the urgency of war going away, but you have a technological change where people are playing catch up on the
right
code breaking side.
Right.
And it takes time. It's a dramatic. People don't realize the kind of the revolutionary change that machine ciphers played.
Well, absolutely. And when you look at the early days of William playing with cipher machines, it was pretty clear to me, at least, that he didn't understand the future impact of what he was discovering. He was playing with them because they were an interesting puzzle, an interesting challenge. But all of the seeds of the big code-breaking successes in World War II, you know, were laid in the 20s when he first started sort of tinkering around with the Heburn and with the Cryha and all of the famous stories about how he, you know, was staring at the Heburn for 3 weeks, completely insensate, you know, not able to go out in public and just consumed by it. And then all of a sudden he's getting dressed for a party one night with Elizabeth, and the solution comes to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had plenty of work during the interwar period, even though the war wasn't happening. There was plenty of work there. And, you know, I guess it's because of the times, Elizabeth kind of picked up the stuff he couldn't do.
Well, people would come to him first, right? Yeah. They would ask William to solve a problem or to come work on a job, but he already had a job. And so they would go to Elizabeth. The reasoning was that they would try to use William's brain secondhand. Mm-hmm. That's what she always said. They were trying to get his brain. They were trying to get access to his brain through me. She kind of resented that, but at the same time, I think she liked proving that she was a master codebreaker in her own right. And what would happen is very quickly after people from the government came to her and asked her to solve problems, she would prove her mettle.
Right.
And then any question of, you know, whether she was, less good than William or anything like that would go away because she was just cranking through these puzzles.
And it's important, again, to understand the context of the times. I mean, this is around the time women's suffrage was getting passed. I mean, the 19th Amendment, it's 1960s sexual revolution, and this is time when women were not doing much of anything outside of the house. And the ultimate end point to this was that Elizabeth gets a pretty extraordinary job working for the United States Coast Guard.
Right. Well, she didn't intend this. Again, this is another accidental thing in her life, in her career, right? But, 1925, a man in Coast Guard uniform shows up on her doorstep, Charles Root, and asks her to help with the rum war. The Coast Guard is completely lost in trying to fight bootlegging. And, they can't break the codes that the bootleggers are using to protect their illegal rum operations. So the bootleggers very quickly figure out how to, encrypt messages, shortwave radios on boats. They set up pirate radio stations on shore, and they would exchange messages and elude the Coast Guard, which was overmatched and unprepared. And so they showed up on Elizabeth's door. I mean, this is what she said all her life. Mm-hmm. This was her complaint, is that men from the government show up on my doorstep asking me to do these things, and the only way to make them go away is to say yes. And the problem for Elizabeth is just that, at that point she was, she had just given birth to the Freedman's first child. She was writing children's books, which was a lifelong ambition of hers. And she didn't necessarily have any intent on going back to the government, but she was just so good at what she did, and her skills were still so rare,
right,
that she kept on being indispensable. And so men from the government continued to show up on her door all through her career.
Well, the Coast Guard at the time was uniquely qualified, and even more so than the Navy or the Army, to do this job. I mean, they basically had the largest array of radio detection systems along the coast, mainly because of search and rescue operations and everything else.
Right.
And so this age of radio that had just wireless, that had been kind of figured out during World War One and how important it was to intercept communications, had really put the Coast Guard in a position to be prominent in these kind of operations.
Absolutely. The Coast Guard had to be able to save a ship in a storm. And for that, they needed a radio. So Coast Guard was way ahead of the Navy and any other agency in terms of radio infrastructure. They had listening stations on the coast, intercept stations. And so they had a source of intercepts, which as people listening to this will know, is very important for any kind of code breaking operation at scale. You need a ready source of intercepts, and the Coast Guard had that. They had the intercepts, but the problem was they didn't have the code breaking until Elizabeth. And so Elizabeth comes in, and she starts to break these codes and solve these messages and distribute decrypts throughout the U.S. Treasury network. And Treasury at that point, this is another thing that I didn't realize, Treasury was essentially like an intelligence community all its own. Had multiple law enforcement agencies within it that were able to share information, narcotics, prohibition, Coast Guard, IRS. And Elizabeth became kind of the nexus of a lot of these different agencies. She was the point of contact for all kinds of investigations. Eventually, she became known as the key woman of the T-Men. You know, T-Man being kind of colloquial for a Treasury agent, sort of analogous to the G-Man of the FBI. Yep.
It's important to emphasize that we're not talking about Elizabeth here as a representative of a large team of people doing things.
No,
Elizabeth did this, and you're really talking about the 30 people that Elizabeth was running.
No, this
is literally Elizabeth did this because it was her and another, like a typing clerk.
At first, for the first couple of years when she was working for Treasury, she didn't even have an office there. She was a freelancer. She would go in and pick up an envelope full of messages, and she would bring the envelope back when they were solved. Toward the end of the 1920s, until 1931, it was just her and a single clerk typist, and they were dealing with, you know, more than 12,000 messages a year.
By themselves,
and it just the thinking about that, reading the documents in the Marshall Library, just quantifying the work that she did. It's just a flood of paper. Just thinking about all of the paper and keeping track of the messages in dozens of different crypto systems for all of the different rum syndicates that had their own codes and their own geographic areas of operation. I mean, there was one memo where Elizabeth was talking about, they would generate stacks of decrypts, and when the stack of solutions got to be an inch thick, they would bind it into a bound volume. And by 1931, they had created 30 of these bound volumes of just rum runners talking to each other. Incredible amount of physical work, patience, dedication, time involved, and it wasn't until 1931 when she finally got some help, and the cavalry came a little bit, and she was allowed to launch her own code breaking team.
And rum runners sounds a little quaint, but this is not Bo and Luke Duke and the General Lee driving moonshine in the back. These are like Al Capone's crews.
Yeah, yeah.
And people at that level, they're murdering people.
In the first couple of years, this is something that this book completely obliterated my image of rum running and what that was. The first couple of years of Prohibition, it really was kind of gentlemen rum runners. You would have a guy in Florida who had a fast boat, and he would make the run to the Bahamas and run the rum back. But the organized crime forced all those guys out of the business. So by 1924 and 1925, it was just gangsters. And it was just really ruthless, ruthless guys. And also the kinds of large, faceless corporations that were difficult to track. You know, her primary nemesis for a lot of the rum years was this criminal syndicate operating out of Vancouver, called the Consolidated Exporters Corporation. Brilliant, sort of intentionally generic name.
Right, it sounds like something.
Right, it's whatever. It's boring stuff. No, this was one of the largest criminal gangs in the world. Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father, was an investor in Consolidated Exporters Corporation. They had more than 60 different dedicated rum vessels that completely spanned the globe. It was breathtaking in scope, and Elizabeth spent a lot of her time tracking the consolidated boats and ultimately testifying against more than 20 of their agents in court.
Well, because it's law enforcement, this is not an intelligence operation, on its face. She was involved in a lot of court cases that were publicly open. I thought what was interesting was the media coverage of her in the court. At one hand, it was incredibly praiseful. I mean, it was, this woman breaks everything, whatever. But it was underhanded condescension and chauvinism shoved in all at once.
Right.
It was kind of the back, kind of patchy on the back while kicking in the ass at the same time. I mean, it was unbelievable how obnoxious. I mean,
Well, the tone of it was kind of like, look how amazing it is that a woman was able to do. It's like one of the subheads in the clips from one of her court cases was just like instantly iconic to me. The second I saw it, I took a picture of it and I sent it to everybody I knew. And this the little subhead in the newspaper article was "Solved by Woman." I almost called the book "Solved by Woman" because it just spoke to me so powerfully of that moment. And yes, you know, she was irresistible to reporters for a lot of reasons that you can understand. I mean, she was described in news articles as, you know, a pretty little woman who protects the United States, a pretty woman in a frilly pink dress. There was a lot of condescension. On the other hand, she was a big story. She was a legitimate story. She was testifying in these major court cases against large criminal gangs, completely out in the open. She would sit on the witness stand, and a lot of what she did was just explain what cryptanalysis was mm-hmm. to juries.
Right.
You know, people did not understand it, and so she had to break it down into parts and try to explain in a very sort of direct and simple way what it was that she did when she was breaking code so that juries would believe that she was telling the truth.
I'd love to see this dramatized, just the banter between the defense attorneys for these scumbag gangsters trying to trip her up on cross-examination. It's like, give me a chalkboard. Just give me something to write on, and then just. You
know, oh yeah, there's a famous instance from 1934 where she was involved in the appeal of this big consolidated exporters case. They brought her back to testify again, and the defense attorney was irritating her. Right, this is a guy named Edwin Grace. He was Al Capone's attorney for many years out of the South. And he was attacking her in the way that defense attorneys often tried to undermine her, which is by suggesting that she hadn't found these solutions by any kind of scientific method. Maybe she had been, you know, told some kind of inside information, or maybe she was just making it up, or maybe one of the words would have multiple meanings. And she just got sick of it, and she asked the judge for a blackboard. And the judge had the bailiff wheel in a blackboard, and she started diagramming the codes on this blackboard in the middle of this court of you know, this trial of gangsters. And she essentially, I mean, it's so funny to me and cool because it harkens back to her earlier career as a school teacher. Yep. She essentially turned you know, a criminal trial, a trial of organized crime figures, into a classroom. And by the end of her brief demonstration, the defense attorneys were mumbling that they had had quite enough of this this blackboard hullabaloo.
And so her fame was relatively short-lived, because for the 5 or 6 years of World War II, she never talked about what she did. So essentially, she vanished from the public scene because she was pulled into the kind of the secret world of a little more organized intelligence. And that had to be difficult for her later on, again, watching William get all the credit for the NSA and having rooms and buildings named after him. But to her credit, she never spoke of what she did during the war, and the documents themselves about her were only declassified after she died. So she never got that credit.
I think at the time, in the late 1930s, when she shifted to secret work, she was grateful for the lack of the spotlight, because she really hated most of the publicity that she got at the time, because it created problems for her. It created problems in terms of she had to deal with the jealousy of male colleagues in other law enforcement agencies who would work on a case. Elizabeth would get the front page headline, and she would have to write, you know, there are all kinds of letters in her files of the marshal where she's just writing to, you know, police inspectors and apologizing for the fact that she's getting coverage. But yeah, I think later in her life, it did grate on her that, that the work that she did in World War II was sort of suppressed, and that somebody else took credit for it and was associated with it in the public eye, which we can talk about.
Yeah, and I think that even more so, and a lot of the listeners will understand this, is that her primary focus, unlike her husband William, who looked at foreign power code breaking with, you know, Purple and other things, was she was doing counterintelligence work. You know, her main purpose was to hunt for Nazi spies, not only here in the United States, but also throughout the entirety of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, well, she was a pioneer of counterintelligence, I think. I mean, she was really doing counterintelligence before the FBI was doing counterintelligence. I mean, she was doing her rum work was classic counterintelligence. Who's saying what to whom? You know, lighting up the darkened network. And she got really good at that, so that at the dawn of World War II, when those skills were needed to light up networks of Nazi spies, she was ready to go. And she had this team at the Coast Guard that she had created in 1931 and trained and built and nurtured. And it was just ready to go to do this work of trying to find Nazi spies.
And you hinted at someone who had to really suck up his chauvinism and deal with her, J. Edgar Hoover. And don't get mad at me out there for those of you that think J. Edgar Hoover is the greatest thing that ever happened. There's well-documented stories of Hoover just basically pushing any female agents out of the FBI and not another one being hired until after he died. But Elizabeth was his only out at this point. His only opportunity to get the FBI to learn code breaking was for Hoover himself to say, "Damn it, give me Elizabeth Friedman."
Yeah, he really had no choice. So Hoover in 1940 began dispatching FBI agents into South America for the first time. For the first time, he had the authority to operate. To do counterintelligence outside of United States borders. He started dispatching FBI guys into South American countries. They were not effective. They had a lot of problems because they got off the plane in South America and they looked like FBI guys.
And they didn't speak Spanish.
They didn't speak...
Or Portuguese if they're in Brazil.
Well, there's a famous story of a guy who was posted to Brazil. He had taken a Spanish language course at FBI in New York. He got to Brazil and he was disappointed to find out that the language in Brazil is Portuguese. So these guys were not going to be able to light up the Nazi spy networks with sort of classic techniques of developing confidential informants, that sort of thing. They really needed to be able to read the thoughts of the spies. They needed code breaking. They needed to be able to intercept the radio messages and solve them. The problem was the FBI didn't have a code breaking muscle at that point. This was 1940. All they really had was the technical laboratory, which was more of a crime lab.
Right. I mean this famous crime lab, right? Hoover brings in fingerprints and a lot of the digital forensics, that stuff that all the things that make the FBI the greatest law enforcement agency in the world today was because of J. Edgar Hoover's leadership. But it wasn't doing intel work. It was doing catching bad guy work.
Sure. I mean, they were justifiably proud of the laboratory for what it did, but it wasn't a code-breaking team. And they really needed code-breaking. And so they went to the Coast Guard and to Elizabeth, and that's when Elizabeth started monitoring these clandestine Nazi radio circuits and giving the decrypts to the FBI, not just to the FBI, but also to British intelligence, to the Army, and to the Navy.
And we can get into some of the specifics about South America, and we will, but the wrap-up Hoover, the ending is promising. She actually does some pretty extraordinary work in South America, but gets absolutely no credit for it because Hoover warps the record completely and gives all the credit to the FBI.
Yeah, well, I think Hoover did this to a lot of different agencies and people over the years. I mean, he was a chauvinist, but I think there were all kinds of people who hated Hoover, men and women. He absolutely was a chauvinist. Hoover was a brilliant publicist. You know, among all the other things he was very gifted at telling the FBI story in the press in a way that would reflect well in the FBI. Increase the power of the FBI and increase his own power. And that's what he did at the end of the Nazi spy hunt. So basically, in late 1944, after, Elizabeth and her Coast Guard team had monitored all of these circuits and helped to interrupt and destroy them, neutralizing this threat, once the spy rings were smashed, Hoover stood up and held up his hand and said to Americans, "The FBI saved you from this dangerous Nazi spy invasion." And he did it across all axes of media. He filmed a TV film newsreel that was distributed and shown to Army soldiers, which you can find on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and type in Hoover Battle of the United States, you can see the 15-minute video that he shot, you know, basically claiming credit for the clandestine war in South America for smashing the Nazi spy rings. He wrote first-person articles in popular magazines, how the Nazi spy invasion was smashed by J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, it would be unthinkable today. It would be like James Comey writing a first-person article in BuzzFeed or something. It just would not happen, right? It's a completely different era, but that was Hoover. And, you know, the history isn't just written by the winners. It's written by the best publicists and the winning team, and that was Hoover. He was just really good at it, and so the result was that he got the credit for it, and people didn't know about Elizabeth's role.
Well, and a lot of the role was things that she couldn't talk about even if she wanted to. I mean, the Coast Guard team under her had broken multiple Enigma variants. Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone wants to give credit to Bletchley Park or to William Friedman or, to the Poles, obviously, started everything. But the Coast Guard team, a very small code-breaking team, broke multiple variants of the Enigma by themselves, including the one that really allows the United States to push a South American country, Argentina, the last hope of the Germans in South America, to break off relations completely with the Germans. I mean, that to me, it's multiple levels of reasons she can't talk about things.
Right.
We're just Enigma, code-breaking, counterintelligence. You know, Germany and South America were all just Hoover didn't care. It's just like, I'm taking credit for all this stuff.
Well, he had the power to speak publicly about these things that she did not have that power. She could not contravene the secrecy rules. You know, I mean, all of her stuff was stamped top secret ultra. So when you I found her the diary of her unit, the technical history of the Coast Guard cryptanalytic unit during World War II. It's in the National Archives. It's 329 pages. The cover says Top Secret Ultra, and every page inside is stamped Top Secret Ultra.
For our listeners, they may be interested to know that Hoover wasn't the only massive personality that Friedman ran into. Bill Donovan at the OSS was also somebody. OSS was stood up. They had no crypto unit themselves. Who else to turn to but Elizabeth Friedman?
Yeah, it was another one of those moments, you know, send in Mrs. Friedman, when it was somebody is kind of unprepared for a challenge or needs a puzzle solved, send for Mrs. Friedman. So they sent for her. She spent 2.5 weeks right after Pearl Harbor setting up the first permanent cryptographic section for the coordinator of information, Bill Donovan. OSS didn't even exist yet. But Donovan needed a secure way of communicating with people in the field. He didn't know anything about codes, ciphers, and Elizabeth Friedman went and set up all this stuff for him. She hated Bill Donovan.
She didn't have a particularly high opinion of old Wild Bill. Some of the stuff you include in the book are some of the very, very politically correct, tactful letters that she wrote, and you read between the lines, and she just wanted just to take him to task.
She disliked Donovan for a different reason than she disliked Hoover. I think that she recognized that Hoover, you know, was a very formidable guy, competent in a lot of ways. I think she just thought Donovan was a clown.
A buffoon. Absolutely. And she's not the only one to think that, but I would love to have, you know, Elizabeth Friedman, tactful translator, and look at some of those. What they would be.
The anger translator.
What they would be if she really got the chance to say what she wanted to.
Yeah.
Because it's so well written in, you know, saying so much without saying anything that would get her fired or thrown in prison. But
absolutely.
It's pretty glorious. For those of you that know a lot about Bill Donovan and his personality, especially the beginning, because he really didn't know what he was doing.
What upset her was that he seemed to insist that he knew what he was doing when she could tell that he didn't, and he would contravene her recommendations. He didn't give her the respect that one should accord to an expert, especially somebody who's brought in to do a favor for you, essentially.
It seems even Hoover grudgingly gave her respect. He kind of said, oh, fine.
Well, Hoover greatly admired William.
Yeah.
That was something he held William in very high esteem. There's a story about Hoover. He would go to Harvey's restaurant. He had a table there with Clyde Tolson. And when he arrived, there would be a bottle of wine on this table. And he had a ritual where he would go around the restaurant. And if he saw somebody who was important or somebody that he admired, he would pour them a glass of wine. And there's a story about him going over to William Friedman, who also ate at Harvey's sometimes. William Friedman looks up. There's the director of the FBI holding a bottle of wine. Hoover pours William a bottle of wine. You know, that meant something.
Yeah. Let's wrap this up by talking a little bit about recognition, because it seems to be coming, albeit slowly. I mean, this book will hopefully make a difference. It's good to see these kinds of stories being written for a wider audience than sometimes gets its due. I mean, there are all sorts of books about codes and ciphers that aren't going to be read by kind of random Americans. They're kind of within the community. And this certainly walks that fine line that we try to do between being readable and being right. I'm happy to say, and this is as much of a glowing review as you'll get from me, that it's both readable and right. And the right part matters to us a lot, right? Because there's so many authors out there who don't have a hand or a knowledge about this world, and they can write very well, but they write garbage very well. You obviously did a ton of research about this beforehand, so it's good to see that there'll be people in the middle, you know, random places that have never picked up a book about intelligence want to know about this woman and learn a little bit about the world that we live in. But it seems like this is coming at just a great time, because there's so much of history being rewritten to include women's roles that had been written out to begin with, right? So it's kind of a rewriting of history, everything from, you know, Hidden Figures to some of the broader understanding of some of the women that were integral in intelligence operations, especially during World War II time period, during the OSS. Did you time this well, is really my long-winded way of asking this question. Are you getting that kind of response from people who are eager to see a story that should have been written decades ago, but because of the environment, the woman's role was written out of it, and now you can actually tell it the right way?
I do think that this is a moment where people are realizing that important pieces of our history have been missed or overlooked. And the thing is, when you go back and you look at the documents, you look at the primary sources, you see that women are there, which is one reason why I find this debate about men and women and technical abilities and women in tech and very frustrating, because it tends to be about these biological arguments, and I think it's just not relevant, because history shows that women have been there all along.
Right.
You know, it's about writing a more accurate version of the story.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as I spent time with the Friedman's letters and the Friedman's writings and just having kind of the Friedman's kicking around in my head for 3 years, you can't do that without, you know, without noticing and paying a lot of attention to the fact that the Friedman's were world historical sticklers for fact. You know, they cared more than anything about getting things right, and you know, sometimes to their detriment, they cared about it so much that it hurt them sometimes. And I do feel like doing the research and writing the book was a chance to give Elizabeth the recognition that that she definitely deserves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that I don't have kids yet, but if I do or when I do, I kind of cringe when people talk about giving little girls these roles, like Grace Hopper and Virginia Hall and Sally Ride and Elizabeth Friedman. These aren't people I want to be role models for my daughter necessarily. I want them to be role models for my sons too.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that that's where starting to bring the lives of these extraordinary people to the forefront, and then kind of them being women just by happenstance and being able to do the same jobs or maybe even the jobs better. I mean, when I talk about Elizabeth Friedman, I'm a firm believer that she was better than William at code breaking. And then, you know, NSA, a lot of the top people will be like, yeah, you're probably right. You know, and that should be a lesson to everybody. This is not just, I want my daughter to grow up to be like Elizabeth Friedman. I want my son to grow up to be like Elizabeth Friedman, you know? And so I did see a lot of that, you know, that's why your story, the Delta story, really resonated, because I see that stuff all the time, you know? And to me, that is why bringing some of these characters back into history, right? I mean, people have been, it's not that they were ignored, they were written out of it.
Right.
You know, and trying to make the record straight so that we actually can get beyond, you know, picking and choosing our role models to saying, like, there's a whole lot of people we can look at to be something special one day.
I do think Elizabeth got her revenge a little bit on Hoover in the end, because she when she was helping William annotate his collection, she wrote some things in the index cards that pointed me and pointed other people toward the records in the National Archives. And you can read these things today, and they're still like little slivers of glass inserted into the library. They still have the power to draw blood. That to me is very cool and very inspiring.
Well, Jason is the author of The Woman Who Smashed Codes, a true story of love, spies, and the unlikely heroine who outwitted America's enemies. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast. We really enjoyed it.
That was so much fun, Vince. Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. We'd like to thank ZipRecruiter for continuing to support the SpyCast family. Remember, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, by going to ZipRecruiter.com/SpyCast. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.